Accession number 16808, wheel 19.
Reg Spittle's Reel 19.
Yeah, so having had a discussion about our situation, which was not very pleasant, we thought it'd be a shame to destroy the tank. I mean, if we couldn't move it, we thought the Germans wouldn't waste time with it. So what we did, we disabled the equipment on the tank best we could. We took the firing mechanism out of the 75mm gun and dumped that, chucked that away, and we took the two machine guns out, which you only have to just undo a slip, you can slip them out with no trouble, remove the breech blocks anyway, so they parted company in the bushes, and the operator disabled the water set without sort of smashing it, and the driver removed all his fuses and everything out of the fuse box, and I took a compass bearing on my maps first, as our position, as where we expected to walk. And then I put the maps, which were cloth, underneath the floor of the tank, because there's a section in the floor of the tank which can be removed for cleaning purposes and maintenance. In some tanks they have an escape hatch, but we didn't have one in a Cromwell. And so I took that up and pushed my maps under there, because underneath there would have been rubbish and oil and dirt, which these mats being cloth would have soaked up and been made unusable, you see. And put it back again. So having done what we thought was reasonably awkward, make it awkward anyway, we set off with my compass and started to walk back. Well, we got about 4 or 5 miles to go at least. And we set off in the dark, and this was in the early hours of the morning. And of the 4th of August, and the strange thing was we never met anybody. I mean, we could hear noise going on, and we could occasionally see fires where tanks were being brewed and burning, and we never met anybody. We just kept walking, and without it being too evasive, I mean, we'd got to walk at a reasonable pace, otherwise we were going to get anywhere. And the only thing was we just didn't talk. And we got our personal weapons. We took the Sten gun and the Bren gun out of the toolbox, because we used to carry a Bren gun with us. And took 2 or 3 of the grenades with us out of the turret. And as I say, we just walked back through the night. And it got to the beginning to get light in the morning, the early morning mist and that. And we finished up at this point in a sort of coming to an open cornfield. And sort of, we were always looking about for anything, and suddenly old Bill Barnett, he said, "There's somebody over there, Reg." I said, "Where?" He said, "Straight." He gave me the directions to look anyway, because he didn't want to point, you know. So I got my binoculars with me, you see, so I looked at my binoculars, and of course the other side of this cornfield was another orchard or something, or other trees or something, and I could see some vehicles camouflaged, you see. So I watched them for a bit, and I said, "Well, I'm sure they're Bren gun carriers. I'm sure they're Bren guns." I said, "Well, anyway, whoever they are," I said, "no," I said, "it wouldn't be Jerry's, not this far back." And of course, by now, we'd sort of left any fighting. It was sort of, you might say, apart from the normal noises that went on all the time, there was no noises that constituted a danger to us, as you might say. I said, "Well, the only thing is," I said, "well, we'll just walk across." I said, "They're bound to be air blokes." So we walked across. I said, "Spread out in a line, so, you know, I can see who we are." And we walked across towards them, and it turned out to be the Rifle Brigade, 8th Rifle Brigade, or parts of the 8th Rifle Brigade. And when we got within reasonable distance, of course they challenged us. I suppose being as we were in shit order, they couldn't tell whether we were Germans or what we was. So, of course, we put our hands up and carried on walking, and they took us in. And this young officer who was with them, he said, "Oh, yeomanry." I said, "That's right." He said, "Yes." He said, "We've had some more in before you." He said, "So obviously there's other people walking about." And during the day, of course, they returned us to the unit in the evening time, towards the unit. Well, the infantry apparently put in an attack that evening to try to sort of clear the situation, but I don't think it was successful. I never saw anything of it, so I don't know. But according to the books, the 5th of August, the Germans decided that they'd had enough or whatever or anything, and it appears the Americans had at last appeared on the right flank, and the Germans withdrew, and it became a sort of, that was the end of the episode. Well, then our regiment was moved back to a village called Bewley, a very posh name, just up the road, a few miles up the road from the Vista. And of course we spent the days there then recuperating, sorting out who we'd got left, who was missing, if possible where they were missing, the casualties, who was wounded, who was killed and all that, and how many more tanks we needed, which was virtually a replacement for the regiment. And by the 12th of August we were supposed to be fully equipped, ready to go back in action. I always had the impression that we were never fully operational in number of tanks, because I've, since the war, when you read books, talk to people and all that, I've come to the conclusion that even at that early date, it had been decided that the Yeomanry were going to be disbanded and replaced by a new regiment, which we were, and that they thought, well, there's no point in sort of making us up to full strength at that time. We, from there on to the end of the campaign, and our last fighting day was the 17th of August, two-thirds strength would be adequate for us to operate regimentally. I've always had an impression. I don't know for sure whether that was the situation, but that's the impression I had. Anyway, the first day's action again was the 13th of August, when we took a little village called Latil, supporting the 159, or elements. We then went on and took the town of Vassy, and the next big place, of course, was Flers. In between Vassy and Flers, of course, were several places where skirmishes took place, actions took place. We were now losing our tanks, but we'd never ever had another catastrophe like we'd had down at Veer. And consequently, we just, any tanks we lost were replaced, and that was it. We just carried on. And a funny thing happened that we had a new, we got this new troop now. I was in a new troop, having lost my troop officer and troop sergeant, who it appears had been taken prisoner. And I now had a new officer and a new sergeant. The sergeant was a chap named Taffy Ellis. Well, he'd been a troop corporal the same as me when we went to Normandy. And like I had been offered my three stripes, which were in my pocket actually, because I was stopped from having my third stripe in Yorkshire, as was related earlier on. And I was very annoyed about it. Not because I didn't get to be a sergeant, but the pettiness of why I wasn't given my third stripe, between this animosity between me and the sergeant major. I thought it very childish of the sergeant major to do what he did, which meant I didn't get my third stripe in Yorkshire, as I was sort of entitled to have. So when it was offered to me in Normandy, I refused it the first time. And the second time, when Bill Bailey brought it up, he said, well, I'm not taking them back, you do what you like. So I stuck them in my pocket, and that's where they were. And I was a troop corporal. So Taffy had accepted his stripe, so he's my troop sergeant. We now had a new officer who was keen, because I think this was his first time in action. So, and as the most of the Germans we met from now on were prepared to give themselves up, they were not these die-hard people now of holding every inch of ground. They were more prepared to chuck the towel in. So now people were taking prisoners, but you still got these points where they did decide to hold on. You got some idiot who thought he was not going to give in yet. And but there was nothing ever serious, you see. And to this young officer, I had the impression that he thought it was all jolly good fun. Because Taffy and Ellis and I were always ready to step back rather than step forward by now. And anyway, we got down to a situation where we should have stopped And they decided, well, there's nothing happening, so we might as well press on a bit farther. And I always felt that it was Fleurs, the town of Fleurs, that we went into. Anyway, we came to this town, and I'm sure it wasn't Vassy, it was further on the Vassy. And it was a town proper, and the only other town was Fleurs. Anyway, we got down, and having no trouble, we still carried on because this young officer thought we should. And we went into this town, into the market square. And it was rather comical in a way, because there are times when you sort of feel you're in control of the situation, and you're sort of by now becoming some sort of a veteran, and feeling that you can deal with situations as they arise, and being in control of them. And we drove into this town, three Cromwells, and we laid up the side of this market square, such as it was, and the Germans were flying about like ants. They were abandoning the town, you see. And what we would call the town hall, they were bringing stuff out, furniture and desks and papers and all sorts, trunks and stuff, loading them up in these lorries, and the lorries were shooting off out of the town, empty ones would come back. No signs of any fighting troops at all. So we sat there sort of quite confident that we were sort of safe and in control of the situation. Now Bill Baggerly, my operator, could speak French quite fluently. Now when I found this out when we got to Normandy, I told him, I said, "No, don't let anybody else know you speak French, because the obvious thing would have happened. They would have took him away from me to use him as an interpreter. And I didn't want to lose him. I didn't care whether he spoke French or not. It was handy, but he was a good operator, so I didn't want to lose him. So I said, "Don't, for Christ's sake, let anybody know you can speak French." It proved very invaluable, you see. So we're sitting there watching all this activity. The tanks are shut down, so there's only the commander got his head up. And I suppose to the civilians, one tank's like another tank, and not expecting any British to be that far forward, they wouldn't be thinking of British anyway. But there was one man, young man, walking round, looking at the tanks, and when he got to mine, he was looking along the side, and I'm on the left-hand side of the turret, there's a turret face 12 o'clock, and I'm looking down at him, watching him, and he's looking at the tank. He's not looking up at me, he's looking at the tank. And I thought to myself, he's a bit too inquisitive. I'm pretty sure he's beginning to realise this is not a German tank. At least he's never seen a German tank looking like this one. Although Cromwell's, if ever you go to the museum, resemble Mark IVs and Tiger tanks in silhouette very much. But once you start looking at the nitty gritty, then you know it's neither of them. Anyway, he's walking round, and he's going round to the back, so he's going to come round to the other side of the tank. And I said to Bill Bailey, "Get your head out, Bill." I said, "There's a bloke coming round your side." I said, "Now speak to him in French, and he won't know whether you're German or English, because if you speak French, the Germans would have spoke French." I said, "Get him up on the turret to talk to him. Tell him to get up on the turret." I said, "Get out of him. Don't let him go." I said, "He's too bloody nosy." So he did that. When he got round there, Bill popped his head out and he spoke in French, and the bloke clambered up. So he told him to, you see. And he would have reacted, if he's told by somebody in French in a tank to it, he'd expect, if it's a German, they'd expect him to climb up, which he did. So Bill got out of him. I said, "You better explain to him that we're not Germans, we're British, but there's nobody, no other British troops here within about 6 miles, that we are only on a reconnaissance, and that he's got to keep his mouth shut." Anyway, the outcome of it was, long and short of it, he jumped down, ran off, and I thought, "Well, that's it, bloody balloon's going up." So I got on the B-set to the troop leader, told him, you said, what had happened, and Taffy. But he came back with a little box, little cardboard box. And he went to each tank in turn and gave us 5 medals each to each tank. And they're sort of a medal that you would have at a sort of a carnival. They're not a posh, solid affair, but it's a medal, gold-coloured medal, with the triple of colours, with a little bit of gold stuff along the bottom. And I still have this medal upstairs, which I'll show you if you want later. And Flo's kept it, you see, in the scrapbook. And she's got it in a little envelope. Said, this is a medal that a Frenchman gave to Reg. And we each, in each tank, had five of these medals, and so I still got mine. Bill Barnett, being a bit of a lad as he was, he wore it and quite proudly. And this was an incident that happened. Well, then we abandoned the town and went back, rejoined the squadron and carried on, having decided that we had better tell nobody about what we'd done. Possibly it might have been better if we had it done for information purposes, but we didn't want to get into trouble ourselves, so nothing was said about it. But eventually Fleurs was taken, and our B squadron is credited with having liberated Fleurs, but in the history books there's always been a controversy between infantry, certain units in the infantry, and the yeomanry as to who was actually in the town first, you see. But for some reason they come to a decision that it was credited to the 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry. And that is what history records, and that is what the plaques and the credits, as you might say, in the town and the area, the credits for the liberation of Fleurs is given to the 2nd Northamptonshire Yeomanry. We used to have trips down there regularly from the regiment, which has gradually dwindled off as the years have gone by. And it finished up sort of where some of the blokes have made personal friends with local people. And the thing is that I think there's still one or two chaps of the second line, who, especially from B Squadron and C Squadron, from Kettering, who probably still go there on a personal basis visiting friends. Probably now staying with the sons and daughters of the actual people I met. But I've never been myself. I've never actually been to Normandy. I've never felt that I wanted to go, because obviously it would never look the same as it was then. They tell me lots of things have happened. The main road from Veere to Caen, I understand, is now a major railway. I don't know. And the railway bank at in Goodwood, which saved our lives, as you might say, a big high embankment about 30 feet high, I understand that's all gone and has been replaced with a dual carriageway. So it would be rather disappointing to go expecting to see something that you're familiar with, which you wouldn't be now. Other than that, I'm not into going. I mean, the association, the Yeomanry Association, apart from the second line itself, every year go on trips to the continent, but being it's mainly the first line, they're usually associated with Holland more than, or Belgium more than Normandy. But they still do trips to Normandy to different places, usually organised by Ken Tate, who's sort of set himself up as a bit of an authority, because he's written about four books at least. He's now a professor of some sort, and he goes around giving lectures and all sorts of things. A nice chap, old Ken, but he's into it very thoroughly, you see. And they still have these trips, but of course they're organised trips. You know, they have parades, they go to the church, they have services, meet the dignitaries and all that, and have a banquet and everything, and the school children involved and all that. But to me, that is not the sort of trip I would enjoy anyway. To go there in your under your own steam, to do your own thing, to go where you want, that would be my idea. But as I say, even that I've never bothered to do. So I've never been back. Other than 1947, we went to a fortnight's holiday to Bruges, where we stayed with some friends that I made during my period of recuperation when we were stationed. After coming out of hospital, we were stationed in the barracks in Bruges, and I made some friends there who were, because I came from Northampton, being in this boot and shoe town, Gaston was a boot and shoe man himself. And it was rather funny, because when we went there for this fortnight's holiday, we talked about everything and anything, and the war and the people and the effects it had on the Belgian people and everything, you see. And of course Bruges is Flemish, and they don't speak proper French if they can help it. They would law on themselves, like you say, like the Basques in Spain. And so he told me these stories about it, and of course Bruges was liberated by the Canadians. And young Peter, his son, who was 5 at the time, was very proud to show me the streets that they came down. Anyway, Gaston used to tell me these stories, you see, and we're reminiscing between us. And I said, well, were you in the Belgian army then? He said, oh, naturally, he said, because they always had conscription on the continent. So he said, when the war started, he said, I was naturally called up straight away. And he said, so when the collapse came, he said, it was total chaos. So he said, I thought the best thing to do is go home, burn my uniform and get my apron on again, being a shoemaker. So, and he was the principal for the district, actually. So he said, I went home, burnt my uniform, and when the Germans came to Bruges, he said, I was cobbling. And consequently, he said, being the principal for the area, they didn't have big factories in those days in Belgium. They had all these little cobbling shops, as you might say. And of course, he had been the local bigwig in the boot and shoe. He had the responsibility of organising all the repairs for the German forces' boots in that district. So he had a lot of contact with the Germans. And something is Suzanne, his wife, never got used to, the Germans coming to their house. She was always terrified. But that was the only time I ever went to the continent. We had a fortnight with them, a very enjoyable fortnight. But other than that, I've never been back, and I never really wanted to. But anyway, getting back to Normandy, we went on, and the fighting went on, and we took these towns, Vassy. We took Le Teil, then Vassy, then eventually Fleurs, and broke out from Fleurs, and we set up then to go out into the country again, as we used to refer to it. And the three squadrons were set out with the B squadron, I believe it was, were aiming for a town or a place called Brunz, B-R-I-O-N-Z-E, I think it's spelled. We called it Brunz. A squadron, which was mine, was on the left, going to a town called Dorset, which we took, without much opposition, as you might say, because by now the Germans were really giving themselves up. And C squadron would below Brunz, and they made contact with the Americans coming round in the bottom hook, coming up from the American sector. And that was, I think, our first contact with the Americans since the first day of Bluecoat. And those were basically the positions on the 17th of August, and when the evening came, we'd already been told that we were going to be disbanded and replaced by the 15th, 19th Hussars, who were going to be brought straight back, straight from England, on the transporters, and they were Canadian transporters. Well, the American Diamond T is the transporters, but they were crewed by Canadians, and they came down in the evening of the 17th, and the evening of the 17th, and they came down with these Diamond T's and the Canadian drivers and that, and they brought down the 15th, 19th Hussars, who had come straight from England, having seen no fighting at all, obviously. And the transports were then going to take us back up to Bayeux, where we were going to be disbanded. I don't think we went back until the following morning, because it was daytime when we went back, so it would have been the 18th when we went back to Bayeux. I've always thought I would like to have spoken to somebody from the 15th, 19th Hussars, because as you can imagine, through all what we'd gone through, the tanks were in a pretty ropey old state. I don't mean mechanically from a fighting situation, just appearance-wise. Mud guards missing, torn off and all that sort of thing, covered in mud, dirt or whatever, looking rather bedraggled. And we probably had our wash and shave during the night, so we would perhaps be look a bit clean. But nevertheless, compared to a unit that has come directly from England, straight down to the fighting, they would be the same as we were when we left Aldershot, nice and clean and spick and span. I've always thought I'd like to have spoken to one after the war to get his impressions of what he thought we looked like when they first saw us. we must have looked a right shit heap. But anyway, we handed over all our maps and talked to the tank commanders. Were keen to come and talk to air tank commanders, and a troop corporal from one of the squadrons was keen to come and talk to his corresponding person, which was me, and we had quite a chat, and I was telling them about it, how it had been and this, that and the other, and trying to help in any way. He was keen to want to know what it had been like rather than what it might be like for him. But the next day, of course, as I say, we loaded up on these transporters and set off back for Bayeux. I think we were probably in more danger with the Canadian drivers on the diamond teams than we had been from the Germans. They did manage to tip one over on the way back. Consequently, in our history book, where you read down the people who were killed, these two are credited with being killed in an accident. The accident was the fact that coming back from Bayeux, and it, what did amaze me, it just showed you how close up support was coming from the backup to the fighting troops, because it didn't seem we went a few miles, not many miles, and we came onto a hard metal road, like a sort of a, not solid metal, but nevertheless metal that was laid on the ground so that you wasn't in soil. And so therefore you've got a hard road all the way back to Bayeux, and they'd done it more or less like the Romans. They just built it in a straight line. They didn't go round things, they just carried on. So you went down one hill, up the other side, over the top, down the other hill, because up through the Bocage it was very hilly, apart from trees and all that. And these Canadians, they were really tanked up on Calvados. They got jerry cans full of it, it's Calvados. And they used to walk backwards and forwards, because these cabs on the diamond teams were terrific things. And they used to take turns driving, you see. And they didn't used to stop the tank to change drivers, the transporter. They didn't stop the transporter to change drivers. They just got out the driving seat, walked round the back of the cab, outside, across the back, and got back in the other side. And the other bloke just scotched across and took over the wheel. And they were really clued up on this Calvados. And my episode was, it was a good job there was nobody close. They got no idea of the convoy. You just set off, and within a few miles you became on your own. You couldn't see the one in front, you didn't know who was behind you. Which was lucky, really, because we, at one point, the chaps who were driving us, we were sitting in the cab with them, because we thought, well, if the trailer goes off, we'd be safer in the cab. And it was unfortunate that these two who were killed decided they'd travel in the tank. And this particular one, they lost the trailer on one of these hills, and it went off and went rolled down the thing, and these two chaps in the turret were killed. And but in our case, we got to a point, and they used to knock it out of gear. When they came over the top of the hill, they used to freewheel down the far side, down the slope. And then when it got so far up, they just tickled the old accelerator, bang it into gear, and crash off up the next side. And in their case, they missed the gear. So they couldn't get it in, so the transporter rolled back. Fortunately, keeping it in a line, straight line, it didn't jackknife or anything. And after going back down the hill and halfway up the other side and back down again a couple of times, it came to a stop in the hill. And these Diamond T's, they looked terrific, powerful vehicles, and they couldn't pull us from a standing start up this hill. We had to unchain the tank and take it off so the transporter could drive up on his own empty, and we drove the tank up and had to reload it and chain it on again before they could continue the run up to Bayeux. And as I said, they were really tanked up on this Calvados. But eventually we got to Bayeux to be disbanded, and as I said, this was on the 18th, and we arrived at Bayeux the same day. Then there was all sort of everything going on. You didn't know what was happening, really. The only thing you was concerned about was getting some food at Daniel and all that, cooking up some grub and everything. And then they were sorting out who had got to go where. Well, in effect, I think we'd got about 30 odd tanks, which, as I say, I think that more or less confirmed to me that they never had made us up to full regimental strength again. We were sort of between half and two thirds strength. And having all Cromwells, we all went to the 7th Armoured Division, the Desert Rats, because they were fully equipped with Cromwell, you see. Apart from the one Sherman £17 per troop, which was their normal complement of a troop, three Cromwells and one £17 a Sherman, you see. Unfortunate for the people in the Sherman, because as soon as the Sherman saw them coming, the first tank they knocked out was the £17 a Sherman, which was the only big danger to the Germans as compared to the Cromwells, you see. So that was the first one they knocked out. Anyway, that was their normal complement.